Good morning and welcome to St. Paul's Bible Study. We are still in the Gospel of Thomas, and I beg your patience as people begin to join our meeting, and we'll get started in just a couple minutes. Thanks.
Good morning, Brother Sarah.
Good morning, Grace. How are you doing?
I'm going to have to leave early. My aunt is in rehab, and I'm the only person that can, and she's being released today, and I'm the only person that can go get her. So I'm going to leave you early.
Okay. Thanks for letting us know.
But we'll see you in 2 weeks then, right?
Let's see.
Because next week you're not here.
Yep. I just have to check the calendar because I don't like to answer without checking the calendar first. But yes, I will see you in 2 weeks. So please feel free to just sneak out whenever you need to. That's fine.
Okay. Thank you.
Of course. Hey, Jeanette, how you doing?
Good. Can you hear me?
It's in and out. I heard good, but not can you hear me?
Okay.
Good morning, Jeanette.
Oh, I'm sorry, Grace, could you hear her?
No, I didn't hear anything she said.
Okay, hold on. Here. I'm going to try to do something, Jeanette. Give me half a second. Okay, Jeanette, why don't you try talking now and let's see what happens.
Okay, can you hear me?
I can hear you better, yes. All right. The tricky thing is I can hear you better when I put a spotlight on you, but it takes me a minute to put a spotlight on you.
Yeah. Can you hear me right now?
Yes.
Okay.
What I may try to do, since you're the only one who's having this problem, is leave the spotlight on you. And then everyone else, if you want to see whoever is speaking, make sure you put it in gallery view so you can see everybody.
I didn't leave it in gallery view. I don't know.
Okay. I only heard part of that. I'm sorry.
I couldn't hear it either.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, let me try removing the earbuds and going back to just the...
Okay, well, we did hear some of that. So you're clearly working on it. And so what I think we'll do is... we'll continue on and we'll just do the best that we can. I'm going to keep the spotlight on you. And so everybody make sure you put it in gallery view so you can see everybody.
How do you find gallery view?
Corner.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Got it. Okay.
Yep.
All right. We are in Saying 31, friends. And I'm happy to say that I think this one won't be controversial, but who knows? I'll start reading first. We'll have a little bit of silence and then we'll begin our discussion. Saying 31, Yeshua said, "No one is a prophet in his own village. No one is a physician in his own home." Let's let that sink in for a moment of silence. All right. What do you think about that?
Jesus and his rejection in Nazareth.
Right. We did see this reaction when Jesus came back to Nazareth, and he had mixed results.
I think it's the fact that the familiar is just so familiar, it becomes taken for granted.
Mm-hmm.
And I've noticed that in my own family. My son has been doing a great deal for his mother-in-law and their family, because the others are all working and he has just retired so he can get her to her appointments, chemos and stuff. And she's become a favored son. Mm-hmm. And her own sons are less so. She knows them. She knows all the glitches they might share. And my son doesn't have those. He, you know, he's kind of the newbie on the road. So it relates to me when I see the part about the healer. And when you think about it, how often it's true, perhaps even with our own pastors, we should think about that sometime when we're listening, because they're the ones we're comfortable with. They're the ones that we feel like we know. And so maybe we don't listen to the real message because we're just comfortable. And so I think, you know, they say sometimes familiarity breeds contempt. I think maybe it breeds lack of attention, lack of deep listening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hey, Marilyn, welcome. We are in saying 31, so you know.
And maybe a little mistrust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you listen more carefully when you're not sure you trust.
And, you know, it's interesting because I try not to fall into these mental traps, but I'm realizing I fell into one the other week. It was this exact issue. I had heard a colleague who was having trouble with one of their employees. Really just, gosh, this person is a diva. Gosh, this person is really difficult to work with. You know, not a great time with the new colleague. And when I heard who the colleague was, and I realized I went to high school with that person. And I thought to myself, yeah, I'm not surprised you're having problems, because I remember that person. But the thing is, high school for me was more than 20 years ago. Closing in on 25, really. And even though they're having problems with that colleague, it means nothing, my experience that I had with them 25 years ago, because it doesn't allow for them to have changed. And Lord knows I've changed in 25 years. Thank goodness we all are able to change.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't allow for that. I just went back and thought of that classmate that I had 25 years ago that I didn't particularly get along with and didn't really respect very much. And, you know, and that has nothing to do with anything. Okay, so two people in high school rubbed each other the wrong way. Well, that's unheard of in high school. And so, you know, despite the fact that, okay, some of her new colleagues are having difficulties with her, gosh, that could be said of almost anybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, someone enters a new work situation and sometimes there are some rough patches. It's a very similar kind of mental fallacy where we think we know a person because we knew them when they were 15. And we think we know them when they're 30 or 40 or 70.
And a lot of water goes over the dam in that length of time.
Yeah, it does.
And every drop makes a difference.
Mm-hmm. Does it ever?
Does. And I would want other people to give me the benefit of that doubt.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I would want them to say, wow, I wonder how Sarah has changed. Because I've changed so much. I wonder how she's changed. But I am not quick to give that benefit of the doubt to other people. And that's eye-opening.
Yeah.
Marilyn, what do you think about this one?
I have mixed feelings about it. I know I have changed a lot since I was in high school. And a lot of it has to do with, you know, the things that you learn along the way and maturity, and even not just maturity, but just aging in general. But I think there's still a lot of you that is the same, basic inclinations and personality. Some things are still there. And I don't, you know, maybe good things and bad things.
Right. It's interesting to me in this saying, the two, let us call them occupations, the two occupations that Jesus pulls out to compare and use, they are two occupations that require you to put your life in their hands. Even in the ancient world, physicians could kill as almost as often as they saved. And so there had to be really a lot of trust with a physician, just like today. I mean, in the US, you can't go giving medical advice unless you're actually a doctor. And the reason is we give so much trust to our doctors, so much trust. Even if we want to have a second opinion, there's still a level of really astounding trust given natural levels of cynicism. And then in a prophet, you know, that's a little, that may be a little trickier for us to really intuitively understand, because we don't have so many prophets from God that we recognize as such. It's not a part of our culture these days, at least not nearly as much as it was in Jesus's time. But the idea that a prophet is among you means that the words that come out of their mouth when they're prophesying are from God, period, the end. And that's a lot of authority.
Can you name the current prophet?
Oh, see, that's tricky. Y'all may argue, and that's fine. I would say that a current prophet who I think is absolutely a prophet, and everything that he says, it happens to be a man, is actually the closest to truth that we can get to in this world. Mm-hmm. Is probably the Dalai Lama.
Okay.
That's what I was thinking.
And you know, Thich Nhat Hanh just recently died, but he was the first one on my head, on the top of my brain. And interestingly, they're not Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And the tricky thing is, you know, I think that our presiding bishop comes close, but there's a caveat. I think that it is almost impossible for a prophet to also hold power.
Why?
Power corrupts.
No.
I mean, that's the short answer. The longer answer is, to be able to get things done, you have to compromise. And so what, you know, you may say these are your ideals, and your ideals come directly from God. And so what you say in that way comes from God. But what you end up having to do is compromise. And I don't say that compromise is a bad thing. I think it is the necessary thing we have to do to move our entire society forward towards God. Not a problem. I am here for compromise. It also makes it really difficult to just live inside of God. And, you know, if the Dalai Lama actually were in Tibet and leading Tibet, he might not be so clearly a prophet of God, but he's not. And in a strange way, that might give him more elbow room to just be in that place of being purely a prophet of the living God.
So, do the prophets see themselves as prophets?
You know, I think that some of them have. You know, I think that Martin Luther King Jr. came really close. But if you've ever read letters from a Birmingham jail, like in their entirety, there's really a stunning amount of generationally predictable, I don't want to say appropriate, casual misogyny in letters from a Birmingham jail. And that does not actually diminish the beautiful, inspiring, amazing things that Martin Luther King Jr. also says in the letters from the Birmingham jail. But there's a stunning amount of casual misogyny in there.
Not everything they say is words of God.
Right. And so the idea of being purely a prophet, that's a really high bar.
I would think that anybody who, like the Dalai Lama, who we would consider to be a prophet, would have the humility to not claim to be a prophet. They probably wouldn't be that bold or assuming, you know.
Right, right. And the tricky thing is, because once you claim a title like that, it's so easy to let pride or ego creep in, even if it is true or was true or is still sometimes true. And yet, the opposite is also true. If you don't claim the title or even acknowledge it in some way, you know, I may not be a prophet, I'm just trying to listen to God, I'm doing the best I can, the ego can creep in that direction as well.
Really,
the ego can creep in.
Will you put Billy Graham and Franklin Graham in that category?
I would not put Franklin Graham in that category because I do not know enough about him. And I don't even know enough about Billy Graham. I know some, but not nearly enough. And so I cannot say yes or no. Because it's an intense label to put on someone, and once you put it there, you can't take it off again without knowing, well, you know, she put the label on there and maybe she was wrong or she failed to put the label on this one and you know she was wrong about that. So I need to hear a lot more from them and about their lives to know. Any further thoughts about saying 31? All right, let's move on to saying 32. Right. Sue, do you want to read for us? Oh, I'm sorry, Grant.
I'm going to say goodbye, okay. I'll see you in 2 weeks.
All right, be well. We'll see you later.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Bye. Sue, do you want to read saying 32 for us?
Yeshua said, a strong city built upon a high mountain cannot be destroyed, cannot be hidden.
Okay, let's let that sink in for a moment of silence. What do you make of saying 32?
I would say it could be interpreted in several ways, but maybe the most simple way would be the city built on this high mountain would be your faith and your spiritual family, is built on a high mountain, meaning it's very important. The height is important, but it's a real firm foundation, your faith in your God and your spiritual heavenly family. And it can't fall and it can't be hidden, and it shouldn't be hidden. It should be preached, to the world or,
Right.
I think the key word is fortified, because you can put a city on a hill and without fortification, particularly from inside the city and the people who live there, I think that's the important, most important thing.
Okay.
But it's easier to protect on a mountain because it's hard for your enemies to get up there and attack. So I agree with you, but it's the mountain is not only important, but it's also a defense location, easy to defend location. So that represents, in my estimation, several things, like importance, defensibility,
It's easy to defend, but you need defense.
Yes. Yeah. I'm just saying it's easier because, it's hard for your enemies to get up there and attack. That's all.
So what are you thinking about this one?
I was thinking more about the part cannot be hidden. I'm thinking it's like the lamp on the nightstand.
Mm-hmm.
You can't hide it.
Yeah.
And you need the light from it. Same way with the city. So taking your metaphor for the spiritual life, you don't want that hidden.
Right.
And like I've been coming across this a couple times lately in stuff I was reading, the light on the nightstand shows light in the darkness, shows much less light in the brightness. And so you don't turn it on because you don't even need it. Everything's bright. So I would say it would be the same thing for, in many ways, for the spiritual side of things, that it's in the dark times that our spirituality shines and needs to show, and we need it to shine light in the darkness.
Yes.
That's beautiful. It makes me think of how it kind of like the lamp, the nightstand shining during the day makes me feel like, good Christians who are, doing what they're supposed to be doing and living a spiritual life and getting closer to God in good times, like unless they're actually telling you, oh yeah, I go to church, I find it really fulfilling, I've got a deep meditation life, and you wouldn't necessarily notice that, oh wow, these people are incredibly good people. These people are incredibly deep people. These people are profound and patient and peaceful and wise, and let me go stand in line with them. Because whatever it is they've got, I'd like a serving too. In the good times, it's not always as easy to see that. But in the tough times, when we need people of peace and compassion, in the tough times, when the amount of patience you have is very clear compared to everyone else around you, then you can see the light that shines from us a lot more clearly.
I think too, following that strain of thought, in the bright times, in the light times, your example, you don't need to speak it. Your example shows it. People know you go to church. People know you help other people. People know you're gracious and kind. And all of those kind of things, it's just obvious, and your example leads the way and teaches its own lessons. But in the dark times, you need to speak up. You need to make your light more noticeable.
Well, and my thought is that if you continue, which can be tricky, to continue to be that light, mm-hmm. even when every urge around you is urging you toward darkness, mm-hmm. toward impatience and unkindness and revenge and deep anger.
Or despair. And just apathy from that.
Yep. That it's harder to be that light. Mm-hmm. But when we can be that light, I tend to think it is so much more noticeable. But not necessarily easier. Mm-hmm. Especially when everyone is in a place of upset chaos. And looking at you like, well, if you're not angry, you don't understand what's going on.
Yes.
Well, actually, there are other options. I can know what's going on and have prayed for it for 2 hours, and I'm calmer now. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any further thoughts about saying 32? Let's move on to saying 33. Marilyn, do you want to read for us?
Sure. Jesus said, "Thou hearest with one ear, but the other thou has closed."
There's more.
There is?
Yes.
Oh, that's why it says 33A in my book. Okay. Jesus said, "Whatever you hear in your ear, preach from the rooftops into your other ear, where no one lights a lamp and puts it under a basket, nor does he put it in a hidden place. Rather, it is put on a lampstand so that all who enter and leave can see its light."
Okay, let's let that sink in a couple minutes of silence. Well, a couple moments of silence. What do you think of saying 33?
One of the commentaries that I read says that Arvin Meyer quotes Clement of Alexandria in whatever, an esoteric interpretation, that what you hear in the ear expresses something spoken in a hidden manner. And in a mystery. So it's kind of like passing along a secret, you know, you whisper it in somebody's ear. And he claims that's one interpretation of that, when you hear it in your ear, because it is a funny expression, you know.
Yeah, it is.
So if you hear something like that passed along more secretively, you want to shout it from the rooftop.
Yeah.
Well, one thing I noticed in my life is that thinking things, reading things, and taking things through your eyes that way to figure things out, when I say things out loud so that my voice actually enters my ears, that makes a huge difference in my understanding of things. And as I've gone through things with my strokes, the doctors have frequently said, "Well, you have to say that out loud, read it out loud." There's other things they say, write it in cursive and those kind of things, but they all trigger the neurons in your brain to take it in differently. And that's just been a revelation to me, is how saying things out loud, like reading these mm-hmm. things out loud, is different than, because then you're taking it into your own ear and you're getting a different access to your brain.
Yeah. And in truth, different people genuinely learn in a different fashion.
Right.
And, you know, I am someone who learns very well by watching something be done and by writing something out. So if I can write something out, that actually helps me to think, because mm-hmm. I'm an external processor. And so I can think and write and remember in a completely different way. And if it's something physical, like a manipulation of an object or something, or cooking or learning a new craft, I just have to watch someone do it. And it absorbs into my brain in a really specific way. And my husband is not that way. That is not how he learns. He's a very intelligent man, but he has to learn by doing it himself. And then we can talk about the process of doing it and making mistakes and how to do it better and more efficiently. But if he doesn't have a frame of context for doing it himself, everything I say is a theory that makes no sense to him. Mm-hmm. And I'd never really worked with someone whose brain worked like that before. It took a couple of years to iron out the difficulties.
A growing experience.
Yes. But I love that idea that, you know, maybe, you know, I love the gnosis angle. Like, here is a secret that is being put into your ear, and now you have to do something different with it than just share it as a secret being put into someone else's ear. And I love the different ways that we learn and know and understand. One of my commentaries says something particularly beautiful. In order to transmit the word, we must first embody it. The sun does not proselytize. It offers its light freely. Nor are human beings proselytes. They simply transmit what they have truly received. They give of themselves not because they are virtuous, but because it is their nature to do. Quote, he loves not as I love, but as the emerald is green, for he is I love. And that idea that the emerald is green, you don't steal its greenness. Mm-hmm. You don't learn how to be green from the emerald. The emerald just gives you green.
And the emerald itself did not learn to be green.
Yes,
nature to be green.
Yes, and it is very deeply green. And similarly, it says you cannot steal the perfume from a rose; it mm-hmm. gives it freely. Yeah. And so then, you know, we are talking about transformation, because we are not a rose and we are not an emerald. But we can become like the rose and become like the emerald, in that we take in something. And then, as my mother used to say, we know it in our bones. Mm-hmm. It's not just a theoretical knowledge. It's not just something that someone has told us maybe over and over and over again. But we know it so deeply in our bones, we couldn't be any other way. It's just become who we are, and to put us in any situation, and we still are who we are.
I like what Sue said a little earlier about liking to write, because I'm like that too. You know, when I get into things, I like to write, and because it forces you to organize, you know, like make paragraphs, you know, on different topics, and, you know, fit them together and so forth. It helps you organize your mind. And also to remember, you can always go back to your notes and get the picture again, the structure, you know, whereas if it's in the brain, it's easy to forget, you know, pieces of it. And, you know, it's a little more, non-permanent.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. To just add to that, and this again is from my stroke experiences, they have studied and learned that if you write things in cursive, Mm-hmm. You will remember them longer and better. Mm-hmm. And there are actually sport coaches that are insisting that their players come with pencil and paper, mm-hmm. no computers, no pads, no nothing, pencil mm-hmm. and paper, and write down the plays that they're discussing in cursive. And the one I read about, he actually would walk through the players to be sure they weren't printing it. He said, I don't want it printed. Those are just sticks. I want it written with curves, because there's something about that activates different neurons. And so I was so upset when they quit teaching cursive. They're starting to reteach it. They're starting to work it back into curriculums in lots of schools. So, yes. So I just think that from a brain point of view, especially with most of us trying to hang on to what we've got, right. cursive is part of the answer.
I love it. Marilyn, what were you going to add?
Although it doesn't say it in so many words, I think it also emphasizes the importance of sharing our thoughts, mm-hmm. things. When it's the other era, perhaps that's your other stuff. Talk to yourself so that you can see more than one side. Mm-hmm. And also share your thoughts with other people, because I don't think you can be the person you're supposed to be by yourself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, that can be tricky because at least in a lot of Episcopal churches, coffee hour can be a place where you can go up to someone and say, what did you think about that part in the sermon where the preacher said, blah, blah, blah? That really fascinated me. What do you think of that? But very often we don't do that in coffee hours. Very often it's, oh, how are you doing? Oh, how's your grandparents? Oh, how's your granddaughter? Oh, you made the macaroni salad. Oh, it's fabulous. You've got to give me the recipe. And the thing is, like, those are valid conversations too. But they're not going to necessarily get us. We're going to stay in the shallow end of the pool. And sometimes starting out in the shallow end, you know, we can keep swimming to the deep end. And then we can do some dives in the deep end and then come back to the shallow end. And there is a place for, you know, the rubber ducks in the wading pool of life. Absolutely. And we need those conversations sometimes just to keep ourselves sane. But there can be, if we choose to make it in our lives, space to go snorkeling in the beautiful coral reef that is a bit deeper than the wading pool. And without a church community or a philosophy group, or if you happen to have a life partner who is on the same level as you are in regards to these spiritual matters, okay, or a very close friend whom you can discuss these deep things with, great. Outside of that, it can be tricky. And so I would encourage you, maybe once a month in coffee hour, to gather up your courage, find some line from the readings or the sermon, even make a note, bring a pencil, and write on your bulletin in cursive. Make a note or highlight or add marginalia. I feel like with Kindles, marginalia has gone out of style, but there's nothing like arguing with a theologian in the margins. It was one of my favorite activities in college. You know, start it there during the service. And then approach someone that you think might be safe and say, what did you think of this? Because I was having some thoughts about this during the service, and I'm really curious to know what someone else thinks about this. And then maybe they'll be like, I don't know. But if they're a safe person, they probably won't hold it against you.
True.
And maybe they'll say, I don't really know how I feel about that. How do you feel about it? Mm-hmm. And then you can say, well, you know, I've been thinking. It's just like this time I had a conversation with blah, blah, blah. And then we can have the same kind of conversations in coffee hour that we have here.
You might even draw in the priest to talk about it.
And let me tell you, the priest is going to love that. Because this is what the priest went to seminary for. Will someone please talk to me in coffee hour about sermon? I'm dying. You know.
Yeah, we'll take great pains to write the sermon and construct it and try to get a message. And let's discuss the message. Did it get across?
Exactly. And the joy is the deep piece of wisdom that you took from it might not have been intended by the preacher, but it might have been intended by God.
Mm-hmm. It might have been a sideliner from the priest, but...
Right. But it was the thing that you needed to hear. Right. In that moment. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it will be the thing that you remember in 3 years. Mm-hmm. That one fantastic sermon that had that amazing line that just spoke to my heart. Mm-hmm. I've gotten parting gifts from parishes based on that one amazing sermon that had that one line that spoke to their heart. Mm-hmm. And I could not remember any such sermon.
Interesting.
But it made an impact. It did what it was supposed to do. Absolutely. And I preached 100 sermons since then. But it did what it was supposed to do. Further thoughts on saying 33? Jeanette, do you want to read saying 34 for us? Can't quite hear you. You'll definitely need to look closer to your camera.
Okay, which one are we on again?
No, it's not working. I'm sorry.
Yeah, have someone else read it.
Okay, I'll read it. Saying 34, Yeshua said, when a blind person leads another blind person, they both fall into a pit. Let's let that sink in with a moment of silence. What do you think of saying 34?
I don't know. Is it all right to disagree with Jesus?
Sure. Lots of people do it all the time. Go for it.
But I'm thinking of, I don't know if you know, everybody knows, but in Batavia, whether it's still there or not, I don't know. But there used to be a school for the blind. And, you know, I'm thinking of two blind people together who have gone to the school and learned all these things and how to live in the world and all of these things. And I think they could probably help each other and wouldn't necessarily fall into a hole.
Okay.
Of course, in Jesus' time, there were not schools for the blind, probably. The blind were kind of left to themselves.
It's true, yes.
And there were no accommodations.
Right. No, they were more likely to be thought of as having done something terribly wrong, therefore they're blind.
Yeah.
But who could be more helpful and understanding to you than another blind person?
You know, I like where you're headed with this, Marilyn. And I think that that's a really interesting point. Here's something to throw into that mix. If a blind person is choosing a seeing eye dog, does it choose the blind one?
No.
No. It's choosing an animal to literally keep it from walking into traffic. You know, those specific situations in our own culture where a blind person needs the aid of someone who is not blind. I do think that your examples are beautiful and perfectly on point and incredibly sensitive to the experience that people who are blind and marginalized because they are blind, and blindness is used as a metaphor for things beyond just blindness. Physical blindness is used as a metaphor for spiritual blindness.
Yep.
And physical blindness is used as a metaphor for emotional blindness. And, you know, and all the commentaries for this one, they're very clear. Yeah, the physical blindness is being used as a metaphor for pretty much every other kind of blindness you can imagine.
I think maybe he's talking about the kind of blindness, and this phrase has been going through my mind a lot lately, not intentionally, but the phrase that says there are none so blind as those who will not see, and maybe that's partly what he's talking about.
Yeah, that is a beautiful quote. I don't know who that's from either, but I love that.
Because the do not see means the person is choosing not to even look or be curious or anything.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And thinking from a kind of therapeutic angle, how many people grew up in, let us just call them dangerous households. Households with abuse, households with neglect, households with dangerous people mm-hmm. raising up.
Mm-hmm.
And it behooved them not to see, not to be curious, not to notice. And only later in life is it even safe for them to consider seeing, to consider noticing, to consider analyzing someone's behavior very deeply. Because, you know, a child only has so many tools in their toolbox. And not seeing is a real good one.
Dangerous.
Yeah, because it's too dangerous.
Yes.
I love the word behooves. It's one of my favorite words.
I love one of the quotes in one of my commentaries. The commentator quotes the Indian sage Nisargadatta. I might have pronounced that properly, and said, those who know what is good for others are dangerous people.
There you have it, our whole situation.
Right. And it makes me think about the rules and the guidelines for counselors and social workers and therapists and spiritual directors. If you want to give spiritual direction, you have to be in spiritual direction. If you're giving help to someone else, you need to be getting help on your own issues. So you need to be working on you, even as you are actively attempting to help other people. Because you are not an immortal sage who knows everything.
Close, but not there.
Close. So close. No, not there. Not there.
Still working on it.
Still, yeah, in progress. And, you know, even if we're right 90% of the time, which is a stunningly high rate for mm-hmm. being correct, it's that 10% that's going to get us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's that 10% that's going to come out when we most need to be right. And we're not going to be.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, though, in this one, it says they both fall into a pit, not might fall into a pit. That seems a little too presumptuous that they will fall. You know. I didn't like that part of it.
Okay. Yeah.
What if they're,
what do you guys think?
They're helping, they're holding hands and one falls down, the other's gonna go with it. So that's, it makes sense.
Yes, and Pitt's probably the way they refer to it at this point in history could very easily be the kind that have been dug for trapping an animal.
Mm-hmm.
So it would not be just a little thing.
Yeah.
It would be a major thing on a trail or a path.
Yeah, where they really get hurt.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
On a humorous side note, I'm reminded of The Vicar of Dibley, if any of you are familiar with that series. And it's a comedy series out of England about the first vicar a small town gets that is a woman.
Oh yes, that was funny.
And there's a lot of humor and a lot of physical humor, and the particular actress is quite an obese woman, and so there's a lot of fat jokes. That's like okay, move on, please. We've had enough fat jokes in this episode. As a fat woman, I can only take so much of that. But there was one beautiful moment where she's having, you know, she's dating a guy. They're doing a charming montage of their romance moments, and they're out walking in a country lane, and they're having fun in the puddles after a rain, and they're splashing in the puddles, and it's like they're youthful and joyful. And then she goes and jumps in a puddle, and she falls in up to her armpits.
Woo.
And, you know, it kind of turns the romantic montage on its head, which was the point. But just this idea of, you know, sometimes those pits are a lot deeper than we imagine.
Yes.
And I think of the Vicar of Dibley happily jumping into a very small, tiny, shallow little puddle and then just losing herself literally up to her armpits. And the look of shock on her face. That's what I think of sometimes.
What happens when we take a plunge?
Right. When we're not just a little bit wrong.
Yes.
We're really wrong. We were really wrong about that one.
Yes. And it's very hard to crawl out of that.
Yeah.
All right. I think we have time for one more.
Mm-hmm.
Saying 35. Sue, do you want to read that one for us?
Yes, was said, one cannot capture the house of the strong except by tying their hands. Then everything can be overturned.
Let's let that one sink in with a few moments of silence. What do you make of saying 35? Jeanette, go ahead and speak directly into the camera.
Could be meant by tying their hands. You know, if it's a metaphor for, attempting to do something to the spiritual beliefs of a person, how do you tie their hands? I don't get it.
Okay, that's a good question. So it's clearly a metaphor. Thinking about the whole metaphor, you can't capture the house of the strong except by tying their hands, then everything can be overturned. Okay, so one way to think about this would be, if the devil has an interest in overthrowing your life, which let us just presume for the moment, for the sake of argumentation, that the devil has an interest in overthrowing your life, how does the devil metaphorically tie your hands, because you are the strong man, so that your whole life can be overturned? Well, there's some easy answers and some more person-specific answers. So a great way to tie a person's hands in this respect would be to convince them that it is a waste of time to pray. To convince them that they are not worthy of taking the time and effort every morning to do the things that make them feel sane and grounded and reconnected with God. Because if the devil can convince you that it doesn't really matter, and it's just a waste of time, then the devil has, to use a different metaphor, begun to undermine the foundation of your faith, that reconnection with God that is very much a visceral feeling as well as an intellectual belief. And if our connection with God can be cut off or made staticky, or is sometimes like how we can't quite hear Jeanette, like we can see her mouth moving, but we can't quite hear her and we have to guess what she's saying because we hear one word out of three. If our connection with God can be made to look like that, then we start making bad decisions other places because we're not making those decisions arm in arm with God. So that would be one way to understand the metaphor, but there can be other ways.
How about Satan introducing very attractive alternatives, like go gambling at the casino and get addicted, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that would be another, I think.
Absolutely. And it could be even more subtle than that. Go gambling at the casino and get addicted is an excellent way to get distracted. But how about check your phone first? Because there's a time and a place maybe that you say, okay, you know, this is when I'm going to spend some time. I'm going to pray, or I'm going to meditate, or I'm going to read the Bible, or I'm going to read an inspiring piece of ancient wisdom or an inspiring piece of modern wisdom. You know, this is my time. And the devil says, you should probably check the news first. You should probably check in on the January 6th hearings, see how they're doing. You should make sure you know what the Supreme Court has decided while you slept so that you can pray about it. And so there we have, for someone who is remotely liberal-minded, the instant red button. The devil doesn't have to convince you to go to Seneca, Niagara. The devil just has to convince you to open the New York Times at the wrong time in your day. Because then, instead of getting calm and praying and reconnecting with God and getting to a place where you could read the New York Times with equanimity, you read the New York Times first. And I'm sorry for picking on the New York Times. They just have really good reporting. You read the New York Times first, and then you're really upset because the state of the world is upsetting. Doesn't matter which side of whatever aisle you're on, the state of the world is upsetting. And so then, A, you have less time to pray and meditate and seek the wisdom of God. B, you're coming into it. I think of cats sometimes. I think of a calm cat who is licking its own tail versus a cat with a dog in the room who is on high alert and it's got its eye on the dog. And even though the cat is this big and the dog is that big, the cat's ready to attack. The cat will go down in this ditch. The cat will save you and you and you, and it will take out at least its nemesis's eyes. And I feel like the difference between reading the New York Times at the wrong time is the cat who is calm and licking its tail and maybe a little snoozy. And you know, you could even give it belly scratches without risking your hands. That's how calm and chill the cat is. Versus the cat who is agitated and angry and upset and ready to attack because the dog is in the room. And why is there a dog even in this household? Which one prays better? Which one meditates deeper? Now, this isn't to say that the prayer and the meditation wouldn't really help calm the cat down. You know, using this as a metaphor for our own lives, the cats don't actually need to pray, they're fine. But which one is going to further deepen their relationship with God, and which one is going to just try to bring down their anxiety level to a manageable level by connecting with God? Like, one takes three steps forward in the path, one gets back on the path. And it's all in the simple choice of, when will you read the news today? Or check your email? Or look at Facebook? Or fill in the blank? Turn on the TV? Mm-hmm. Turn on NPR? Very small choice, very large impact. Does anyone want to leave us with one last thought?
To me, it made me think of all the times raising my kids that a Sunday sports game or a Sunday invitation to a cottage at the beach or something like that would totally disrupt the plan for going to church. And how easy it was as they grew older to make those kind of choices, you know, the easy choice, the lovely choice, the fun choice, the coach's choice when they were on traveling teams, that kind of thing. And how hard it was to argue against some of those things, especially when it was a coach or a music director demanding that they be there at the same time that you should have been at church. And it's, you know, tough calls and follows through the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. So hands were tied and brains were sort of switched in other directions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you, friends. I will see you in 2 weeks. I won't be around next week, but I will be here the week after that.
Looking forward to it.
Well, thank you. Right.
Thank you. Have a beautiful July 4th. And I'll see you soon.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you. Bye, everybody.
Bye.